Okay, ladies and gentlemen, just to give you a little bit of flesh on the bones about us. I think you'll be able to tell this just looking at us, won't you? I think Nina and I have been doing youth and children's work for about 40 years. Feels even longer than that. And our backgrounds are in education. I was a secondary teacher, Nina was primary. We have three grown-up children now, three granddaughters. I then did schools work for 13 years with Scripture Union, then went to Oak Hill, taught the Youth and Children's Ministry course there for 9 years, and I'm now pastoring a church and trying to kill it as I go. So that's just a little bit about us in terms of our backgrounds. And we did think of doing a role play on anger, but we decided we wouldn't, because it's okay. We could do it too well. I think it would help us to know what age group, for a start off, you're from here when we're dealing with this stuff, because obviously we've got 45 minutes. This is going to be very, very kind of introductory as a session. So if you're dealing with fives and under, I'm just going to hope that Nina can look at this. If you're dealing with fives and under, can you just put your hands up, please? Right, a few. If you're dealing with ages 6 to 10, could you put a hand up, please? Okay. If you're dealing, and we'll just chomp these all together, if you're dealing with 11 plus, could you put your hands up, please? Okie dokie, thanks. Okay. We also don't know quite what you're expecting from this, because there could be a whole range of reasons as to why you're here. So let us tabulate about six possibilities that we've come up with as to why you might be in. Hello.
Are there any more notes?
I don't think so. I'm sorry.
There might be people who can share.
Yeah, if there are families or couples who could share, that would help. There's one volunteer there.
Thank you.
There's about three or four spares knocking about here. If folk haven't got at the back, please don't feel embarrassed, because the notes will help you. Are we done? Yeah? Thank you very much. Okay, so here are some possible reasons that you may have come here, and things that you may be expecting us to try and think through with you. One, anger is disruptive to relationship and discipline within the groups that you run. Two, it's a common feature of childhood and the teen years. Three, it's unpredictable. And because it's unpredictable, you can sometimes be just living on the edge, waiting for that child or that individual to blow. And that's not a very comfortable feeling when you're doing children and youth ministry. Four, in its explosive form, it's an obvious emotion, and it demands attention pretty immediately. You can't just brush it to one side like an answer to a question and say, well, we'll deal with that later. It demands attention straight away. And obviously, quite rightly, because we want a degree of order in the way that we do our youth and children's work, and I hope you're committed to that, then that means it's something we will have to address. So those may be a range of reasons as to why you've come here. There could be others, but that's our suggestions. So here's the first thing that we want you to think about. Why did God give us anger? Because we do need to recognise that emotions are God-given. Alright? He has created us with the capacity to engage emotionally with our world and with the people in it. That is part of what it means to be an image-bearer of God. And I use my language slightly loosely here, so forgive me, but there is a sense in which God is an emotional being. Now, that's not quite true, because not quite true, all right? But just bear with me for the sake of analogy or sake of illustration. All the emotional range, if you like, that there is available is perfectly held together in God. So God can be at one and the same time perfectly joyful and filled with love and full of anger and deeply grieved. All of those things can be held together in harmony in his being, in his nature. And so therefore we need to recognise that emotion in and of itself, and anger in and of itself, is not necessarily a bad thing. Okay? We're not very careful when we come to something like this. It's always, or anger is always negative. Not necessarily. We said here, not all anger is sinful. There are about 500 times in the Bible the word anger is mentioned, and fear, which is associated with anger very often. If someone is fearful, they react angrily very often. It's a way of expressing that fear, that angst. That's mentioned 300 times. And many scriptures refer to God's perfect anger. I've given you a few of them there. You know that Jesus is perfectly angry when he drives out the money changers from the temple. Okay? And anger can be a right response to wrongdoing. So when he is healing the man in Mark 3 with the withered hand, it says that he is deeply angry with the responses of the Pharisees to the grief, to the need of this man. So it is quite possible for there to be a right anger. Think of Nathan's little conversation with David after he's committed sin with Bathsheba. And Nathan tells this wonderful little story, and the response of David is fascinating. David burned with anger. Was he right to burn with anger? Yes, he was. What he just heard brought anger out in him, and it was a right response to the evil story he'd just been told. In fact, it was him, actually. It was a neat little twist. Okay, but you get the point. It's not that Nathan says, you shouldn't be angry. That's not the issue. It's, you're the one. You're the one that actually you should be angry with. Okay, so not all anger is sinful. We need to recognise that. And secondly, negative emotions, anger is part of that, can play a part in protecting us. Okay? In the same way, for example, that physical pain tells us that something's wrong with our body and acts as a protector, emotional pain can tell us there's something wrong in our lives. Okay? And that is actually a positive function from a negative emotion. Someone has said that anger is an emotion God gives us for the purpose of destroying something. I'll repeat that because I think that's quite profound. Anger is an emotion God gives us for the purpose of destroying something. And the inference here is that what is being destroyed there is harmful and deserves to be destroyed. And that's why in Ephesians 4:26, which we just very skipped over very quickly, we're told, in your anger, do not sin. Not don't be angry. When you're angry, don't sin. So we just need to hold that, because we're going to locate a lot of our time now in terms of dealing with anger, where I think it is wrong, and helping children hopefully to work that through. But please bear in mind that there is something back of this, a bigger context within which anger is right and proper, and we need to help children with that. So, Janina, she's going to take
it. All right, so let's look at what the problem is then. If that's the setting that we're talking about, that God has given us a range of ways to express our emotions, and anger is not always wrong, let's look at where it is wrong. I noticed in the description for the session this afternoon, the assumption is pretty much that anger is going to be something that we're going to want to deal with. In other words, there's something wrong about it. So let's have a look at that. I'm going to return to that description later. So what's the problem with anger? Well, sin is almost inevitably the warping of something that is good. Satan is not a creator. He is a spoiler. God creates what is good. Satan comes along and warps it and turns it into something destructive. So sin, if sin is the warping of something good, this anger that God has given that should be directed towards things that are wrong becomes misdirected and becomes destructive when it's used inappropriately, and where it's misdirected and not promoting good, not directed in an issue, but far rather is directed towards a person. Very often if we're angry, we don't get angry about a particular issue. Our anger gets directed towards somebody. And that's the same with children and with teens. So what we're talking about is the wild and uncontrolled form of anger, And I'm not just talking about exclusions, I'm also talking about the internalising of anger, and I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. Because our hearts have been corrupted by our rebellion against God, what was intended for good has become dark and oppressive. So the Bible identifies anger more often than not as a problem. And we can see that in, I won't go into these verses now, but Proverbs 16:18 and 14:29. Thank you very much. So when it comes to the young, we should note that Proverbs is written with the young in mind. It's a teacher teaching a father, a mother, a man teaching his son. It's one generation to the next. And so there's lots of advice in there. Also, anger is singled out with reference to fathers and children in Ephesians 6, verse 4. The one thing that is singled out as a thing that can be provoked in children through their fathers. If we're about discipleship in our children and youth work, then this will not be seen as something, a side issue that we address, but key to our work. As we were talking about in the session before last, we want to address the heart, and anger begins in the heart, and so that's where we want to address. But first of all, let's look at anger in general. We've got here, where are they on the spectrum? I think we ought to ask, where are we on the spectrum as well? Some people give vent to their anger very, very quickly. Provocation comes, and there is an immediate response. A quick answer, nasty words, maybe an explosion. Some people react very, very quickly. Other people are slower in their reactions and can internalise their anger. And it can actually take a lot longer to work through when we're like that. So if we're a venter, the kinds of things we might do are yelling and screaming, throwing and kicking, talking back, quarrelling, using biting sarcasm, name-calling, using profanity or contemptuous words. They're the kinds of things that are an instant reaction to a provocation. If we internalise our anger, it's going to show in sulking and pouting and crying and withdrawing and retreating, going for a walk or a drive, getting away from the area of confrontation, or giving a cold shoulder, maybe for weeks at a time, you don't know. But somewhere between those, we will find ourselves somewhere along that spectrum. Some nearer one end, some nearer the other. And of course, some of us explode and then withdraw. And some of us have a long period of internalising and then build up to an explosion. But somewhere around there, we will be able to identify ourselves. It's important when we're addressing children and young people that we don't forget that. Because when we're teaching them, if we're teaching them, something's come up in the Bible, maybe about this particular issue, we need to be able to give personal examples. We give biblical examples, we give examples from other people, maybe biographies or people that we know, but we also give personal examples. And that, I think, carries its own power, because we are fellow travellers with them. We're not the experts who never lose our temper. We're not the experts who never sulk or pout. We still do it sometimes, and we need to be demonstrating to them that God is at work in us. So helping a person deal with anger. There are some books that we've found particularly helpful in this area. One of them is a book called The Heart of Anger by Lou Priolo, which we have here. There's a workbook that goes with it. I'm afraid I haven't got the original book with me because I've lent it to someone and it hasn't come back. But the workbook part of it is here if you want to have a look through that later. Really, really helpful book. And another one is by the same author, Getting a Grip. And this is for teens and parents and youth workers. The Heart of Anger Handbook for Teens. So it's similar material to this one, only put in a more kind of age-appropriate way for older children. And what he says there is, very often when children and young people or we ourselves are angry, What's really at issue is that we don't know how to communicate well. He's not saying it's not a sin. It is sinful when our anger either turns in on ourselves and is destructive in our own hearts, or when we direct it against other people and we're destructive towards them. That is sinful. But it can come about because we haven't really thought about how we communicate on a basic level. And Lou Briolo talks about three ways of communicating: words, tone of voice, and body language. He calls it the communication pie, so it's divided into three parts. Now, of course, our words have power to harm or to heal, to build up or to break down, and to cast down or to raise up. We are therefore meant to choose our words carefully, and we need to encourage our children and our young people to do the same. So the first thing that we need to make them aware of is their tone of voice. Our tone of voice must match well-chosen words. This morning when we had I don't know how many of you were in the session on under 11s, but there was some role play going on there, and somebody was talking about the judgment of God imaginatively with children, and smiling all the way through and using a really merry voice, where it's an obvious mismatch between tone of voice and content. But we can do the same when we're communicating with each other, and very often children are not aware of this. Voice inflection can communicate bad attitudes. So you can say, for instance, a child could say to its mother, "No, I wouldn't like any more dinner, thank you," when she offers some more, in a way that says, "Not in a million years, and I couldn't hardly swallow what I had already," or, "Well, I am full, but it was really nice, but I can't take any more." The tone of voice can convey that. Without anything else, the tone of voice can convey things on multiple levels. It has been said that the message is communicated up to 7 times more by the tone of one's voice than by the words that you're using. So this is often the most inflammatory element of communication with teens in particular, because teens do know that tone of voice matters. And they know that they can project the rebellion while actually saying something that seems to be harmless. The other thing is nonverbal communication, which would include eye contact, gestures, posture, and touch. Now, we know this with young children as well, that they can use their bodies to communicate the fact that they're resisting you. But I think even more with teens, that's a tool that is used. So words, tone of voice, and body language are all indicators of what's going on in our heart. It's an overflow of the heart. Our words and our actions and our attitudes are an overflow of what's going on inside. Think of a jug full of water. When you tip it over, water comes out. With our hearts, words and actions and other ways of communicating come out. It says in Matthew 12, "The mouth speaks out of the overflow of the heart. A good man out of his good treasure brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of his evil treasure brings forth what is evil." So this is very, very glossy, but just to go over, it's very shallow and just an introduction. The first step towards good communication is to encourage children and young people to stop, to look at you, and to listen. Stop, look, and listen. So in the childhood years, we're presented, and in the teens, we are presented with an opportunity to equip them with communication skills that will help them to be a blessing to other people, including their future spouse and children, if that's how God leads them. What we do with children and young people in our families, as well as in our churches, is hugely important. A prerequisite to all this will be the development of self-control.
Okay. So you see that if you do have a situation where someone has exploded, for example, or has withdrawn, whether they've vented, whether they've internalised, it's very important to, if possible, bring that situation into a relational and a communication situation by getting them to stop, to engage with you with their eyes. I know it's a different context, but when I was a secondary school teacher, I would never, ever engage someone in terms of correcting them until I had them looking at me. And I was like, when you're looking at me, we'll continue. Now, that's slightly, I'm not asking you to do it in a youth group, but the principle is, once you've got them looking at you, that you can then begin to communicate with them. Okay? And you can begin to share some of the concerns, and then to listen with care, rather than interrupt. And it may well be, to start off with, particularly if someone has completely withdrawn into themselves and or has completely lost it, then effectively what's happening is they're drowning in their emotions. Their emotions are like up here. And if you want to try and reason with them, it will be impossible for them to reason with you. So some kind of calming time will be necessary before you can engage in this stop, look, listen process. Okay, you can't do it immediately. Now, the problem is that if you are typical youth leaders and children's workers, the chances are you don't have that many spare people who can take child X off to calm down. And you may want to ask some questions about that. Of course, you've got to write down the answers anyway. I appreciate that this sounds great in theory, but you are going to have to sort of be aware that sometimes that is essential before you can begin this process of addressing their hearts and getting to think through what they've just said or done. Because, coming back to the notes now, this is to do with self-control. Now, let me define self-control for you biblically. It's one of the fruit of the Spirit, okay? But biblically, self-control is not self-sufficiency. Okay? That is not what the Bible's talking about. That is not a fruit of the Spirit. Okay? Because if that was the case, then you wouldn't need the Spirit. Okay? It's not self-sufficiency, nor is it self-effort. I can do it. Okay? Point is, they can't do it. That's why they lose it. Alright? This is dependency on God to work in them by His Spirit. That's why this is called the fruit of the Spirit. Okay? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. Right? And people without self-control, and you know this as well as I do, effectively do what they feel like doing. And there is a whole generation in the last 20 or so years that have come through our world, our society in the UK, who essentially have been told, you have a right to express yourself. Well, that's a disastrous message with a sinful heart. It makes perfect sense if you believe that children are innately good. You don't need to hear this. If I actually believe that a child is essentially a good being, and that all they need to do is to be given the right environment in which to grow up, a kindergarten, a little child's garden, where I give the right soil and the right conditions, and I plant the seed in the soil, and I water it with nice circumstances, and hey presto, I get a beautiful flower that smells luxurious, then of course I'm going to say to them, express yourself. Because all I expect to come out is goodness and beauty. But if I believe, as the Bible says in Mark 7, out of the heart flows all manner of evil, then the last thing I want is that expressing itself. All right? I want to put boundaries on that. I want to help the child or the young person to put boundaries on that. I want them to rely on the Spirit to check their emotions in order that what comes out is not going to be destructive and ugly. All right? So it's very, very important you realise this. There is a philosophy, a way of thinking about childhood that actually is so anti-biblical that it has produced this generation, and you and I have them in our churches. And these kids do not realise that, because no one's ever sat down and actually explained that to them as clearly as I just explained it to you. They're products in that sense of this kind of way of thinking. So how can we actually help a child or a teen to really become self-controlled in the biblical sense of depending on the Spirit and working appropriately? Well, once you've got them to calm down, once you've got them in a position where they can look at you and listen to you and engage with you, here are some questions that you would be well advised to ask them. What happened that provoked you to anger? What was it that pressed your buttons so that up you went or in you went? Okay? Next,
What did you want or desire or long for when you became angry? What was your goal in becoming angry? What was it you were after? It may have been to smack your brother in the eye. Okay? It might have been to snatch back the sheep that you just had stolen from you. It might be to push the person off the seat because they just pushed you off the seat. That's the goal, do you see? They've got to think about what it was that caused the thing in the first place, but then how did they respond? And what particularly were they after? Then, thirdly, and this is where the gospel comes in, what does the Bible say about what you said to, say, me when you became angry, or what you did when you became angry? What's the biblical term? Don't get them to say it's sin. Get them to say it's wanting to hurt the other person. For example, I did hit them. Or I did hit them. Okay? Or wanting them, wanting the seat for myself, stealing back. Get them to think, try to give them the vocabulary to think in biblical terms about what it is they've just done. And finally, what should I have said or done when I became angry? In other words, how could I have done it? Well, no, hang on, I haven't got one yet. Here's what I've done, here's the drive, here's what the Bible calls it. Okay then, what should I have done? Okay? Not push the person off the chair, not smack him in the face, not give him a mouthful, or whatever it is. Okay? And here's the final question. What should you do to change the situation? So now you're kind of asking them to think through the whole process again and say, if I was in this situation again, back 2 hours ago, or whenever it was, how would I be different? And how am I going to make sure that I don't repeat that behaviour again? Alright? Now, one of the things that's important is in this whole process of discussion that it isn't one-way communication. It's not you firing the questions alone. It's not you giving the young person or the child a clear direction in terms of what you think. That's part of the process. They must be allowed to appeal, by which we mean this. They must be allowed to actually say it as they experienced it. They must be allowed to say, excuse me, can I just say something? Can I correct something? They must be allowed that. They must feel this is a communication exercise, not a one-way traffic download from you to them. Is that making sense? Okay. So how do we then move a person to repentance? This is where the next set of resources that we haven't actually talked about comes in very useful. This is called the Young Peacemaker. And I've got the next point from this publication. Mm-hmm. It is written for young people.
Excuse me,
I'd love to. Can we try those ones there? I can see people going like this, and I'm thinking, this is bad.
Thank you.
Okay? Right. So, all the publications we're mentioning today are American publications, and let me just say a little word about this. Down the years when we've done stuff, sometimes in a UK audience there is a kind of, oh, it's American.
Oh, it won't work.
And yeah, there is some stuff that isn't going to travel culturally, but there's an awful lot that will. And we don't do that, do we, when they come to watch the American soaps or when they come to sort of read American comics? Yeah, so it's American, it won't work. Okay, so just to check yourself a little on this. Yes, there will be some translation needed, but essentially some of this material, the only reason we've got this material is because we haven't discovered anything in the UK written for the UK market. If we had, we would be recommending it to you. Alright, but The Young Peacemaker is written for teens, and it's certainly worth having a good look at. You've got these titles all at the end anyway, helpful books, they're all mentioned there, so don't worry. But here we go. Here's what they call their 5 A's strategy. 1, admit. Here you are wanting to encourage specificity rather than vagueness. All right? We're kind of amplifying some of these questions we've already thought about. In other words, I admit that I was wrong to answer back. That's specific. It's not just I was wrong or I did wrong. No. In what way were you wrong? I was wrong to answer back. I was wrong to call her app, whatever they did call her. All right? Make it specific. There must be detail in that admission. 2, secondly, an apology. And here we're thinking about the impact upon the guiltless party. This is almost like what they're doing in witness statements these days in courts. The impact of the crime upon the victim. Do you know what I mean? That sort of thing. That's almost this, I think. So, for example, I am sorry for hurting your feelings. Well, there's the person who's being asked to recognise what they have caused in the other person. Or, I am sorry for embarrassing you in front of your friends. It's specific, but it's also recognising the impact that's been caused. Thirdly, accept. And I think this is probably the most difficult step of the three so far. The goal here is for the person to accept the rightness of the consequences for what they've done. That's really hard, isn't it? Really hard. Because what they're going to want to do, if they're classic sinners, back to Genesis 3, what's the first thing that comes out when God calls Adam and Eve to account? They, to use an American phrase, blame shift. They're running for cover. It was her, it was him, it wasn't me. Okay? And so to accept that actually there are some consequences for what you've done wrong basically means not running for cover, not seeking to blame other people, but accepting, yeah, I got it wrong, and there are some consequences that follow. For example, this is not an anger example, but it will do. I accept actually that I should get naught on my exam paper because I cheated. That's the consequence of my wrongdoing. Okay? And they must really, really work on this because, as I said, to blame shift, to look to pass the buck, is just a classic sinful response. You do it, I do it. Why are you in a bad mood today, Ian? Oh, well, it's because so-and-so has not done what I wanted him to do. Really? So it's so-and-so's fault for not doing what you hope they do, for you being in a bad mood? You see the problem straight away? I'm not to blame for being in a bad mood. It's that person over there. We all do it all the time. And as Nina said, when we're teaching about this stuff, and I hope we do some teaching on this to our young people and our children, I've been quite challenged in preparing this. I think, crumbs, I really need to teach on this. Use personal examples. Own up. Don't give the impression you have never, ever in your life thought like this. Do you know, I'm really surprised at you saying that. Really? You're surprised at them saying that? You've never thought like that about anybody else? You've never had a problem like this? You're so remote from the real world of sin, are you? You're so saintly that you've arrived? That's the message you convey, and it's a message of hopelessness for them. Because it means you don't live on the same planet as them. No, all you are is further along the track. And so hopefully you've learned some skills about how to pick the baton up again and hopefully make sure the relay is finished at least. Okay? It's very important that you get them to accept and that in teaching this kind of stuff, you demonstrate some of the struggles that you have, which will convey a lot to them. Fourthly, ask. That is, they ask God and then others forgiveness, and it is in that order. We go back to the Nathan-David debacle with Bathsheba. What's fascinating is that, it's 2 Samuel 13, when Nathan finishes off his kind of attack on David and exposes him, as God's mouthpiece, he actually says, David must realise he has sinned against me. And that then translates into Psalm 51, where David says, against you, you only have I sinned, O God. Well, surely that's hyperbole. Surely that's way over the top. He's murdered Uriah. He's made Uriah's wife pregnant. And he hasn't sinned against them? No, it's a first order offence. It's because he has sinned against God that Uriah and Bathsheba have suffered in the way that they have suffered. Do you get the point? And the young person needs to see their anger and their bad treatment of person X or Y or you in that context. It's not just a horizontal damage that's been done, i.e. between human beings. It stems from a vertical break with God. And it's important that they therefore ask God's forgiveness first. and that they then seek forgiveness in the other person. And that's something that, I'm not sure we do very well. I know I don't. It's not, I think, just enough to say, I'm sorry. Because I think a lot of kids will be forced into doing that, and actually they can say it because they have to. But to say to someone, will you please forgive me for what I said? For poking fun of you in public? For saying those things I said about you? Will you please forgive me? Is a far greater test as to whether their heart is engaged with what's going on. And I'm sorry. Thank you. Because forgiveness actually invites restored relationship, you see. By saying to someone, will you please forgive me, you're wanting that relationship that's been damaged at that point to be brought back together. Fifthly and finally, alter or change. And this is about thinking about what can be done differently next time, which we've already thought about, but it's worth just emphasising this again. So here's what you're wanting them to really think. With God's help, next time I'll ask for permission before getting the football out of the cupboard and kicking it around the room. Can you see? If that's the issue that's led to the inflammation and the anger and the outpouring and the difficulty, whatever it is. But with God's help. Not, I can do this. I've been told off and now I'm going to respond with self-effort and self-reliance and I can manage. No, no, no. With God's help I'll do this. Okay. We need to understand, I think, very carefully what we've said to you here. In biblical terms, what we're dealing with. We need to work through this in our own hearts. And we need to then communicate lovingly and effectively and decisively to the young that we're dealing with. Some of what I said certainly will be way beyond those of you who've got your 0 to 5s. Okay, the reasoning involved, you're just not going to be able to be there and go there. And maybe Nina might be able to help us in a minute. Think through maybe how we could deal with that. But once you're getting past that, 6, 7, you can begin some of this reasoning process. Some of it can start to be implemented. The sooner you do it, the better. Because you're training them to guard their hearts and to think through. Okay, here's a helpful checklist just to finish, and then I think we've got maybe 10 minutes for questions. Okay, I'm going to say helpful checklist and then he's going to finish up. Again, this is taken from The Young Peacemaker. 1, conflict is a slippery slope, by which they mean simply, once you go down, it's very difficult to stop. Once you lose it with someone, you don't quite know where it's going to end. Okay? Secondly, conflict starts in our hearts. That's very, very important. It is our heart's response to what's going on. Look, one more thing I need to say about culture. Let me give a personal example. When our youngest daughter was 15, she ran away from home. She was a missing person for 5 days, I think, and it took us 3 weeks to get her back home. Police were involved, social services were involved, then it took us 2 years to begin to unpick the mess. And it wasn't because we were constantly rowing in the home, she was actually an internaliser. She had taken some stuff that had hurt her deeply and just buried it, and eventually it came out in this massive explosion of rebellion, and she just disappeared without trace, without warning. The wisest, and actually what had provoked her was that when she was 10 years old, it transpired, she'd been badly bullied on a church camp. Very badly bullied. And we have no idea. Now, when we found all that information out, that the pastor of the church that we were in at the time gave us probably the wisest bit of advice we've ever had when it comes to dealing with conflict and difficulty and damage in a family context. He said, your daughter is both a victim and she is an agent. She is a victim because she's been badly bullied. But she is an agent because she has made choices based on what's happened to her, which are foolish choices. And you, as her parents, need to ignore the victim route, because where's that going to take you? What are we going to do? Are these girls who bullied her when she was 10, they weren't Christians. And they were actually members of families in the church that we knew quite well. So are we going to have warfare with them? Are we going to break off relationship with them? What was the good of that? Where does that take us? It takes us into a blind alley of conflict. where the blame is all their fault. And if they hadn't done it, our daughter wouldn't have done what she did. No, no, no. Where we needed to go was agency. She was responsible for the way she reacted. She had made choices, foolish choices. Instead of talking it through with us, with other safe adults, she chose to internalise it. She chose to build up a world, a secret world of friends and relationships that we knew nothing about. Yeah. She chose to construct a web of lies to make sure that we never found out what was going on. Those were her choices. And we could address those. And it's the same with children. Okay? Conflict starts in their hearts. It's no good them placing the blame on other people or other things. If you want a biblical example, think of Joseph. Did he have good cause to feel sorry for himself and to blame everybody for the mess he was in? Yeah. Did he? No. That's the point. That's the point. Thirdly, choices have consequences. They must see cause and effect working out here. Fourthly, wise way choices are better than my way choices. That would be a good summary of our daughter. She didn't make wise way choices. She made my way choices. I'll do this my way. I'll sort this mess out this way. Which, of course, only made it worse. So fifthly, and this again is emphasised by what I just said, the blame game only makes things worse. Yes, of course you want to listen to a child who's suffered and who has been provoked, but not in such a way that they then excuse their own responses. That's the issue. I'm not saying they don't have a case. That's where the right of appeal comes in, the need for them to be able to say something. Sixthly, conflict is an opportunity to grow in knowledge. Now, we don't think this, do we? We think when we have an outbreak of anger, and it just is sometimes, it's a certain case with adults, they've never had road rage. You know, I feel like someone's been sick over you. They're just vomiting words, which are malicious and it's horrible. And so therefore, you don't actually see it in line six, but actually, wherever you have conflict in your children's work or youth group, it is an opportunity. It is an opportunity for that child to grow in godliness, to learn repentance. Don't see it just as an irritation. And the problem is, to be frank, if you are at the end of your tether, it's Friday night, you've had a hard day, a hard week, and the last thing is, oh, this is a wonderful opportunity, thank you, Lord. You know, you just don't think like that. I appreciate that, all right? But try and discipline yourself. Actually, no, this is an opportunity, because I'm dealing with this child's heart now. There's a heart issue, I'm dealing with a real person. Seven, the five A's to resolve conflict. Eight, forgiveness is a choice. They can make a choice to forgive. They can, and they should. It's never too late to start doing what's right. So it doesn't matter whether you're dealing with teenagers, you can still instill some of the stuff in them. Here's something for them, think before they speak. That's the self-control coming in. In dependence on God, I'll open my mouth at the right time. And when I do speak, it'll be respectful. And twelfthly, a respectful appeal to an adult can prevent conflict. So where they're seething about something because they feel they've been misunderstood, okay, encourage them to speak it out carefully and wisely. Okay, so there's 12 things for you to think through, and I'll just hand over to Nina. Thank you.
Very quickly, because we do want, I think the question time would be important, because we've done a lot of theorising. You're going to have practical things that you need answered. The description of this session was, do you have a teenager in your group who struggles with anger? I think the answer to that is, we all struggle with anger. You don't just have a teenager in your group who struggles with anger. You don't just have a child in your class who struggles with anger. We all struggle with anger. And in light of what Ian said about our youngest daughter, the children that worry me the most are the ones that are sulking or withdrawn. More so than the ones that are exploding. You know what you're dealing with an explosion. But often it's very, very deep what's happened, whatever is causing them to withdraw. I think that's something I feel particularly about, obviously, having in light of what's happened. Or a child who has regular temper tantrums, same thing. If so, how can you deal with the immediate issue in a way that is appropriate to the situation and keep child protection guidelines? Do you want to say something about that very quickly in a second? And how do you address the heart, I think we've majored on that, of the young person, to help them turn to the God of grace for both help and forgiveness?
Just quickly, so far as I know, and I haven't checked this up as recently as I'd like to have done, so far as I know, child protection does not prevent you restraining a child if they are in danger
either doing damage to themselves or another. I think that is allowed. Okay, so don't feel that you can't actually restrain them if they're causing likely to cause damage. All right? Okay, we've just got 5 minutes for questions. I'm sorry I haven't got any longer, but any questions that people want to answer, ask particularly because Nina said it may be in the questions that some more kind of helpful detail will come out than we've been able to sketch, given that we're just trying to introduce this topic. So any questions that people have or situations that they want to mention, my wife will answer. Thank you.
Would you say to a child comes to you and say that I want to kill myself?
Okay.
That can be really...
Okay. So a child who is expressing suicidal tendencies, of what age? Ballpark teenager?
You're talking about nine.
And do you know their parents?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you hear the question about?
Well, personally.
Okay.
Hello. Hello, how are you doing?
Yes, okay. So, you don't know very much about family context?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
Yes.
Do you have thoughts on that to start with?
Yeah, I think I would go where Nina's going to start off with. I think I would really try and find out what's happening in the family.
Yeah.
Because the chances are that that will be the major source of difficulty. I think I'd try and find out from the child what's happening at school.
I wouldn't say the family is the obvious.
Well, no, but it may be, just because there may be tensions there.
Yeah. They are tensions there.
Okay.
Okay.
But we mustn't always make that assumption.
No.
No.
And I think I'd also try and assess whether the child, and I'll use the phrase, I don't mean it as unkind as it sounds, whether the child is a drama queen or an attention seeker. Because there are certain children that know how to press our buttons, and if they say to us, I'm going to kill myself, they know that we'll react, and that gives them the attention they're desperate for. And it may be it's not related in any shape or form, hence Nina's comment, to the family or to the school. There's something internal in the child which is saying, look at me, I want to be noticed, and this is a way of getting attention. So you need to do three things. It's arming yourself with information about the family background, information about the school if they're there 25 hours a week, okay, which most children are, and information about the child themselves and what they're like as a personality. And that will involve probably watching them. So watching how they respond with other children. Are they loners? Do they dominate groups when they're in them? Are they able to work together and play well with others? Or do they separate themselves? All those kind of things you're watching for will give you a fair clue as to what sort of child's... Is that okay?
Yeah, but it's not a child protection issue, though. Depends on the seriousness of say, if it's got a self-harmer, it's whether you're managing that.
So, sure.
If she's in a school setting, she gets herself in serious trouble. If she's not informed, kind of, you know, teachers or whatever.
Yes, but I think even teachers would want to discern, first of all, what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are children who just draw attention to themselves, and actually there is no evidence when you... There's nothing going on, and so it's not that you're wanting to be unsympathetic, but it's also you're wanting to check what
it's just protecting your own back.
Well,
just
yes,
in case something does happen when you're in that kind of work, and you've got it where 20 different agencies have seen that young person,
sure.
Nobody's actually spoke to each other,
sure.
And then you end up with case
further.
There's that, but there's also the case that if you report something to somebody in authority, it can get carried away right over there, and the family can end up with huge problems. We experience that because you can get caught up in a system then. So it's two things. You've got to cover yourself, but you've also got to cover the family in a way, and
it's a really tricky area.
Sorry, yes. Because this is quite close to my heart as well.
Okay.
The child has said this. Well, at what stage do you tell the parents that your child is telling me this? Or your child's posting this on Facebook? Or do you just say, well, I'm going to watch the child? If in the time when you're thinking of watching a child...
Unless I have evidence that the parents are causing that damage, then I would tell them pretty quickly. I mean, if you suspect that there might be parental cause of the difficulty, that's a different issue. But if you have no evidence for that, and good reason for having no evidence for it, it's not just a gut reaction, then I'd involve the parents as quickly as possible, because they need to know what their daughter or their son is saying.
If I can give you an example, which isn't a kind of suicide example, but one of the things that Ellie made a choice over was that she started experimenting with drugs. And the youth leaders in our church got to hear about it because somebody told them. They saw Ellie, they didn't step in and come between her and us. They saw Ellie and said, you have a week to tell your mum and dad. And if you haven't told your mum and dad, then we will be having a word with them. So they didn't interpose themselves between Ellie and us in our relationship. They were reinforcing the home relationship by giving her an opportunity to deal with it first. She didn't. And then they had a conversation with us, and then we had a talk with her as well. So we saw an example of where that didn't happen, didn't we, on a television programme one time. It's a Christian group who had made contact with a youngster who was self-harming. And the girl formed a relationship with these people because they showed her a lot of interest. She was with a single mum. Her mum was a single parent. And she rang these people from school and said, oh, you know, something terrible's happening, I'm feeling bad and I'm going to go and do this. And the Christians rushed around and collected her. And in the television programme, her mum was interviewed, and she said, I feel as though I'm not involved. They've taken my daughter away. And this was a mum who was very supportive of her daughter. So it's important.
It's very difficult. It's a whole tricky area. Yeah. What we're saying, try and reinforce the parental link where we can, so long as we've got no evidence otherwise. Sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, just in relation to that, I've had experience with people, children, young teenagers, exposing things like that. And something I find that's been really important for me is I write down everything they have told me.
Sure.
Or it's
keep
so easy to
keep a dated record. So if we're getting near child protection issues, yeah, you're immediately into a diary record with dates.
Don't see a child on your own.
The oldest here, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing I thought would be helpful, a friend of mine who's a special needs educator, and when children have a bout of an outburst of anger, there's a huge rush of adrenaline, which will take 45 minutes to wear off. But if triggered again within that 45 minutes, they'll get hit again and again and again.
Okay.
So there's a 45-minute gap, really, that you need to tread very carefully.
Thank you.
Which I hope that will help.
You've got 45 minutes, folks. Thank you very much.
But after that, it's
good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.